Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Since the 2024 election, rights and protections for LGBTQ plus individuals have been steadily eroding. Conversations around trans kids in particular tends to sensationalize the fight over how they should be allowed to live. We hear stories of families moving, sometimes multiple times, to locations where their children can get the gender-affirming care they need. And even trans adults are seeing their right for self-determination taken away. A little later in the hour, we talk with Jill Lima, president of PFLAG Cape Cod, and Ann Sylvia, board member of PFLAG with a non-binary adult child. But first, journalist Nico Lang joins us, author of American Teenager, How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era. Welcome, Nico.
Thanks. It's so great to be here.
So it was some legislation that was proposed, I don't remember, was it Texas or Michigan, that sort of prompted you to write this book. Remind us of that story.
Yeah. So I tell it, you know, at length in the book. So when all of you buy the book, you'll get to read it again. But the shortest possible version is that a mom I knew in Texas, you know, called me sort of, it was like early pandemic days-ish. I don't know, although a lot of it's kind of a blur now. And she was just totally freaking out because her state had introduced this bill that would make parents of trans kids child abusers. And under the law in Texas, that would make you a felon. And she was just sort of wrapping her mind around this because she's a pretty dedicated activist. You know, she goes to the state capitol every 2 years to fight against anti-trans legislation. So this is something that she was really familiar with, having a trans daughter in Texas. You have to be familiar with this stuff. But it was this whole different ballgame, right? You know, essentially, on one hand, you know, in previous legislative sessions, it would be like legislating her bathroom access or trying to legislate her ability to play sports. But then the idea of like jail time on top of this was just so surreal and unthinkable that when I listened to her on the phone, I just really realized at the time that we needed some sort of moral intervention in terms of that you had all these lawmakers who were trying to throw her in jail without ever bothering to meet her or to meet her family. Because, you know, I'd heard these stories over and over again that, and we capture some of them in the book, that you'll have these really amazing kids and their wonderful parents who travel all this way to, you know, to talk to lawmakers, to try to make a difference, to try to like personalize the stories of themselves and their families. People don't listen to them. They don't take meetings. They don't, you know, they don't want to hear from them. They don't want to know about this because it would make them feel bad. It would make them it harder for them to sleep. And I felt like with a book like this, I wanted to make it really, really, really hard for Republican lawmakers to sleep because they need to know the lives of the people who are being impacted by this. Because it didn't stop, you know, with that bill. We're just seeing in Kansas the devastation that's being wrought and that they are stripping trans people of their driver's licenses there. So if you have a corrected driver's license, like I'm a trans woman with an F marker on it, on my driver's license, and I live in Kansas, that ID was just revoked. And without ID, it's harder to get a job. It's harder to vote. It's harder to participate in daily life. It's harder to drive. Like I profiled a woman in Alabama who couldn't get a corrected driver's license and she didn't want to lie. So she just didn't drive. And we're seeing just over and over again the ramifications of this hard right propaganda. And I just feel like a book like American Teenager is the only way that I have to combat it, which is like allowing trans people to tell their stories in their own words and to show people this isn't scary. It's just people trying to live their lives.
Exactly. You bring us into the world of 8 trans and 9 non-binary teenagers. We get to know them and their families, and you can't help but empathize with their struggle. You write of Wyatt. Wyatt himself, still in transit, not yet arrived, with his ultimate destination not yet in sight. He's just trying to be. And I think that's in many cases, right? These are children who are really trying to live their lives for someone else, a parent, a peer, society, while kind of hiding inside who they are. And you really get to see that with these kids, that struggle and that pain that they go through. And as we know, the suicide rate among these kids is very high.
Yeah, I think it's so funny that you brought that little like passage up about Wyatt, because it made me think of something, Mindy, and this might seem like a non sequitur, but just like go with me here. When I was in college, I had a really tough adjustment process because I grew up really poor. I didn't have, like, it was kind of a miracle I went to college in the first place, right? And I just didn't have a lot of like financial or like social support. So I had to sort of figure out everything myself. And I was having a really, really, really hard time and just making a lot of mistakes. So I started seeing the school psychologist, you know, at my college. And during one of our first sessions, you know, I asked her the age she was when she felt like she had her life figured out, when she just felt like it was like settled. And she just burst out laughing. She apologized because she knew that that was like kind of unprofessional, but she just couldn't stop laughing. And she was just like, "Oh, sweetie, you'll never really figure it out." Right. And there's something just so profoundly universal about these kids' struggles to find themselves. Right. Because it's something that I think we all go through as people. It takes so many years of trial and error and sort of focus grouping and workshopping your own personality, right? Until you figure out what works for you, how to be in society, you know, how to be a person that you love and are comfortable with. Like, who is the best you? Who is the you that you want to be in the world? And these kids just go through that really, really acutely. And they have to battle a government who tells them that they can't do that the same way that all other people do. And it's just so surreal to me that I wanted people to read these stories, to get to hear from Wyatt and to really relate to him, to feel like that something he captures, something they've had to go through themselves, or maybe not them, but their children or their friend's children or their brother or their sibling or their parents. You know, the struggles they're fighting are so universal. We just treat these kids like they're sea monsters who were recently discovered at the bottom of the ocean, rather than human beings who are having the same universal experience that everybody else has. Like, one of the things I love most in the book is that you get to see these kids not only grappling with anti-trans legislation and, you know, and social groups in high school, things like that, but also just like feeling out, what books do I like? What am I reading right now? What resonates with me? Like, one of my favorite moments in the whole book is me debating philosophy on a balcony for 2 hours with a 19-year-old trans girl who'd been reading Kierkegaard and had, and I started reading Kierkegaard because I found out she was reading it and I wanted to seem cool. And then I had to read Spark Notes to Kierkegaard to understand it. But we just stood on the balcony for like 2 hours debating this like weird book and like what it means and what does it mean to be a person? How do we want to use our time on this earth? There was just so much that was so deeply human about that conversation. And it really showed me how much humanity has been denied to trans kids. So with this book, I just wanted to give a little piece of that humanity back and hope that society returns that gesture in kind, that when we make the world a little bit more human, we also make an America that's better for trans kids.
You traveled to 7 different states with different laws or proposed legislation. We have these different families with a diversity of experiences. You know, some are wealthy, some are not. There's different religions. How did you choose the kids that you were going to highlight in this book?
Oh, sure. It's funny because everybody thinks that I like there was some sort of like rubric or something, right? That there were certain like boxes that I was looking to check. I'll say that it was important to me that the stories were really different from each other. Like, you use the word diverse, and diversity and inclusion, that's important to me. But I didn't want it to be like, oh, you're going to be in the book because you're this family or that family, or you fit some sort of pre-prescribed idea I had. Like, I just wanted chapters that would feel really disparate from one another because I wanted you as the reader to not get bored. I felt like if you were reading 7 stories of the same story over and over again, that would probably get boring and you wouldn't finish that book. But I think for me, the thing that I looked for were stories that I felt like I really understood or that resonated with me in some sort of gut primordial way. Like, just as an example, everybody always assumes that I picked the Muslim family to be in the book because they were Muslim. And that's kind of true, but not in the way that you might think. My minor in college was Islamic World Studies, and it felt really good to use it because that's like $150,000 not waste. That felt really nice. But the first time the mom and I spoke Maha, I just really got her. There was this way she talked about her parents that felt like, oh, okay, I know this person. I know you because I am you. Because what's really interesting is that when Clint came out as trans, her parents have been really supportive, actually, even though they're like these very observant Muslims. They got on board. They had some initial struggles, but they got over it. That said, when it comes to Maha being a very free-spirited, independent Muslim woman, They haven't really gotten over that one. They fight about it all the time. And they will probably be fighting about it for the rest of this woman's natural born life and maybe in other lifetimes afterward.
I just have to bring something about Clint since you said that. Clint told his family about his gender in eighth grade by giving his mother a baby shower greeting card reading, "Congrats, it's a boy."
Congrats, it's a boy. Yeah, it's great. What a kid. Well, to me, it's like the fact that that family has like gotten so united on that, right? And, you know, despite their sort of like different places that they come from, just sort of their own like ideologically and politically, you know, they've become really united in like fighting for Clint. I think that that's really cool. And it really challenges some of our like perceptions about Muslims or like these like ideas that people might bring in. I love telling stories that challenge people's assumptions, that sort of flip these like notions and these like tropes on their heads. And that just feels so much more true and authentic.
Like Ryden being the most popular boy in his school.
Yeah. Yeah. That sometimes it's like people do have these sort of conflicts in their lives, right? That family, you know, might have a lot going on, that Ridian does have a lot going on, right? Like he lives in Alabama, this state that at least politically and legislatively, you know, doesn't want him to have the same rights as everyone else does.
Yeah.
But he's been able to find this wonderful, supportive, lovely community in semi-rural Alabama, this place he was not told that he could have something like that.
Yeah.
He goes to an LGBTQ plus affirming school, one of the few of its kind in the entire country, the only one of its kind in the South. And when I tell people that exists in Alabama, they're always absolutely shocked.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I love that I get to challenge that. But I have to ask people, why are you so shocked? Why does this shock you? Some of the most amazing organizing that I've seen in this country is happening in the South. Some of the most amazing queer organizing I've seen has been happening in the South. So just giving to provide visibility for that and to really provide like authentic, nuanced representation for these kids. It just feels like a really cool thing to do. Pardon my French, you can bleep. But like, you know, in the middle of all these things, all this happening in the world, it just feels like a little bit of hope right now. And I think we all need that.
Yeah. We're talking with Nico Lang about their book, American Teenager, How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point, and we're talking with journalist Nico Lang about their book, American Teenager, How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era. So it isn't only the kids who are experiencing pain, but the parents. You know, what parent wants to see their child in pain, right? In these stories, we find supportive, loving families for the most part, but that isn't always the case. And as much as I was reading and feeling for the kids that you write about, I couldn't help but think about maybe this is another book that it would be harder to do, I think, but the kids who don't have any support, in their lives. I mean, you know, that's terrible, a terrible thought.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you just said it, Mindy, that as much as I would have really loved to have included more of those kinds of stories in the book, there are some sort of structural factors at play as to why that was impossible. One of which is that no family is going to let you in their house for 2.5 weeks to tell you about what bad parents they are. Like, that's just not going to happen. People are really protective over their stories, and they're worried about, feeling misrepresented in a project like that. So a family like that is just going to be really cagey. They're not going to let me in.
Right.
And then on top of that, there are sort of certain like legal things there, like for Wyatt, or not for Wyatt, for Micah, for instance, in West Virginia, you know, they have a dad who isn't super supportive and we don't hear from him in the book. And because he wasn't being interviewed, I wasn't allowed to make strong statements about any of that, because in order to include that story, my publisher was pretty insistent on balance, right? That for legal reasons, we would also have to interview him. And I just knew that the family and Micah would be really uncomfortable with that. I didn't want to make a bad situation for them or something that was going to put them on edge or feel really vulnerable. They were already being vulnerable with me in so many ways of being honest with me about these really hard things that have happened to them, you know, allowing all of us to see this like vulnerability, right? To be put in a book like this forever, that requires a lot of trust.
Yeah.
And I just didn't want to ruin that by asking of them something that would be impossible.
Yeah. Since you brought up Micah, you spent 2.5 weeks embedded with these families. So you witnessed the highs, the lows, sometimes, we know, whatever they were experiencing. I wonder if you might talk about Micah, who did experience some intense depression when you were there with him. Normally, you're just kind of riding along. I think in Micah's case, you maybe express more of maybe your opinion or thoughts than you might have with the others. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think I did a lot of having to negotiate what is my role as a journalist there and what is my role as like a human being, because, you know, Micah was really isolated in a lot of ways. You know, so to sort of set the scene, Micah at the time, 18 years old, black, gender fluid kiddo, uses multiple pronouns, so pretty much anything is good. Lives with their mom, a white lesbian, in sort of the outskirts of Charleston, West Virginia. And when I first met Micah, the reason I wanted them to be in the book, or one of the reasons I sort of envisioned them of having a spot in this, is that I just found this really lovely tension between the fact that they are, you know, multiply marginalized in all these different ways in a place like West Virginia, but also have just this like lovely, ebullient, over the top, like warm personality. I sort of described them as like an Appalachian Valley girl. And they're really like that. They're just so sunny and just always like, and this is such a cliche, but truly always bright in every room they step in. They're just such a wonderful person to know. But when I got there, you know, when I showed up in West Virginia to spend those 2.5 weeks with them, I saw how challenging it is, even for a sunny, lovely, bubbly, warm person, to deal with a place where they just don't have a lot of resources for them. Because I feel like really, you know, that's the story of Micah, right? That you have this kid who has everything going for them, except that they live in a place where they just don't have a lot of supports, or they don't have a really big support network to support them. So it means that when they sort of like trip or fall or have things going on in their lives that feel like this major setback, there aren't a lot of people there to help. So for me, I had to ask myself that, you know, I'm there for 2.5 weeks. I'm one of the only other adults that they can get like input or an opinion from, right? And, you know, one of the only queer adults specifically. So is there a way in which I can overstep my bounds a little bit to try to like offer a little bit of help or a little bit of mentorship, or just every once in a while making a little bit of a suggestion? Like, it was very different for me. I've never done something like that before. I've been doing this for 10 years, more than 10 years, and I've never had to step in that way before. And I don't, to be honest, I don't know if I made the right calls in those circumstances, right? Because I was always like making the best decision I could with the information that I was presented sort of on the ground in the moment. But I just felt like I had to be empathetic and just help when I could. It's what I would have wanted when I was my
sister. And I'm going to a little bit of a spoiler here. You do end the book with an update on how the kids are doing.
We'll use Wyatt for an example, right? Mm-hmm. So Wyatt is our South Dakota kiddo. At the time the book was written, was living in the state, sort of just has a really great family, has a really great supportive community, but just hadn't really found his people. You know, he hadn't found those like great, like that close friends like gaggle of people who just get him and understand him and make him feel like seen and at home. And, you know, when the book ends, he goes to find that somewhere else. He starts at one school, he doesn't find that. And then he moves to another state entirely. And now things are going really well. Like, he's like starting to like click with folks, to like find his community, to really like come out of his shell in that way and just feel really understood by his peers in a way that he's never had before. And the fact that these kids are still having to, or are still finding that, I think is really great. What I want folks to take away though, is that it shouldn't be this hard. Mm-hmm. You know, they're having to fight not only their state lawmakers, but all their also their national lawmakers as well in order to do that, right? And they're having to go these like great distances, often leaving their homes and their communities behind, you know, to find where they're supposed to be in the world. It's a great sacrifice, often to their own families. Like Ruby in the book has to go to France, right? Mm-hmm. To flee all of the anti-trans legislation that's happening in the US, because she feels like that's the only place she can be safe. And I'm glad she's safe. I'm glad she's there.
I love Ruby. Ruby was one of my favorites in the book, honestly. I loved Ruby. I'm glad Ruby's
doing it.
Yeah. And, you know, we talk about this various legislation before state lawmakers, and the battle that these parents have as advocates, and then these kids who have to get up there and offer testimony only to be shut down again and again. It's exhausting. And you write, the most emotional testimonies come from parents who say their transgender kids blossomed when they were able to see their true selves in the mirror for the first time.
Yeah. And it's that story that you tell there, Mindy, or that, you know, we tell in the book. It's one I see over and over and over and over again. It's fascinating to me because on the day that the last Supreme Court decision about gender affirming care in Tennessee came down, there was, as a journalist, I spent my whole day just talking to trans activists about what does this mean? What's next? Yada, yada, yada. And at the end of the day, I talked to an activist in Tennessee, actually. I asked my pretty boilerplate questions. To be honest, I didn't think that I did that great of a job because I was really tired. I've been talking to people all day. But at the end of the interview, the activist thanked me for the questions that I asked. And I just thought that was so strange. I was like, oh, I thought that I asked pretty easy stuff. And then I was just curious, what kind of stuff have people been asking you? And they said the whole day, people just keep asking me about detransitioners. Like, what about that 0.2%? What about this? What about that? What about that? What about the people who regret it? And as somebody who's been doing this work for such a long time, I've been working with trans people, with trans kids for 10, 15 years. Like, I just hear over and over and over again from parents, not that story that they were trying to force, but the story we tell in the book of these kids finding themselves and blossoming and just like really coming out of their shells when they're able to finally be themselves. It's like, for listeners, imagine a time in your life when you weren't able to be yourself. Think about how hard it would be to be kept from being you and how much it would mean to finally get to do that, to just get to walk your own footsteps, to live your own life. It's the biggest thing in the world.
Yeah, I was thinking of asking what you hope people take away from the book, but you're sort of answering that. So I'm gonna for my last question, ask you, the people who I think should be reading this book are not likely to be picking it up. So how are you, and I know you've got this long tour you've been doing, how are you getting these conversations started to get some of the people who should be reading this book reading it?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Mindy. I really like when people ask that, actually. I know to some it might read confrontational, but it's like, No. It's a good question, right? How do we do that? Like, how do we get to those people like on the other side? And I think it's something that for me, I've been thinking about pretty much from the jump, that this might sound insane, but I've been doing it. I'm trying to reach out to just about every affirming congregation in the country, right? Like all of the cool, inclusive, pro LGBTQ plus churches. I've been sending them emails about this book to just let them know that this has happened, right? This is a resource. This is if you want to know the stories of these kids, here's a book that can help explain all these things that you don't know. And sure, it's you might say, well, you're going to the inclusive churches. Shouldn't you be going to the mega churches or something? But here's the thing. Not everybody, even in those cool inclusive churches, is necessarily on board or knows a lot about this. There was this data that really gooped me after the election showing that I think about 45% of people in UCC, so that's United Church of Christ, this is pretty liberal, progressive Christians, 45% of those folks voted for Donald Trump. And that really surprised me. I wouldn't have thought that. But it just showed me that even in spaces where we think we have all these allies, that those allies need to be educated too. So I've been doing that of just reaching out to those churches to just send them an email. And even more than that, you alluded to this already, but I've now done 176 events in cities and states all across the country. I think I've been now to 47 states. I'm definitely going to get to those other three. We're working very hard on it. And I'm planning to travel all the way through the next election. I'm planning to spend the next 2.5 years on the ground just bringing this book to different communities. And what I do is I don't go to bookstores. I think that I love bookstores. So if you're listening to this, bookstores, it's not a comment. It's just that I feel like I'm able to do the kind of work you're talking about a little bit better when I go to unexpected places. So a lot of the time I go to churches. And I do a lot to email members of the community, activist groups, advocacy groups, other faith spaces, you know, community leaders, to tell them that this is happening, and please to come out. And, you know, with that, you know, we get typically about like 60 or 70 people to one of these events. And even if the kind of people who are going to show up are those cool progressive people who are always going to show up to something like this, they know those people who need this book, right? They know those people who, I think everybody needs this book, but some people have a little bit of a farther journey to walk, you know, and they know those people who are on that journey, right? So I feel like they have a little bit more access than I do. And I tell people specifically, like, if you've come here and you get it and you're an ally, that's really great. I need you to be my disciple. I need you to sort of reach out to those people I don't know, to go into those rooms that I'm never gonna get to go into, and take them this book, or just lift up these stories, or like be that sort of ambassador. Like, we need as many allies as we can get right now. And I just think a lot of people have really sat this one out. They feel like it's too overwhelming, it's too scary, and they just need to protect themselves right now. And I get that, I understand that, it is scary. But if we have even a little bit of privilege right now, even the tiniest bit, we have to use it for people who are really suffering, because they need to know that we're there for them.
Nico Lang will be reading from their book, American Teenager, How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era, Thursday, March 26th at Hyannis Arts Hall, and Thursday, March 31st in Provincetown at the UU Meeting House. We'll post more information at capeandislands.org. Thank you, Nico, so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Coming up after a break, we talk with members of PFLAG Cape Cod about LGBTQ plus individuals and families on Cape Cod and the islands. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing challenging times for LGBTQ plus youth. Joining us is Joe Lima, president of PFLAG Cape Cod. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Ann Sylvia is board member of PFLAG. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
So, Joe, tell us first a little bit more about PFLAG, who you are and what you do in the community.
Sure. My name is Joe Lima. I'm the president of the PFLAG Cape Cod chapter. And as we say at the start of every support meeting, PFLAG is an organization of LGBTQ plus people, parents, families, and allies who work together to create an equitable and inclusive world. We are hundreds of thousands of people and hundreds of chapters from coast to coast who are leading with love to support families, educate allies, and advocate for just, equitable, and inclusive legislation and policies. Since our founding in 1973, PFLAG works every day to ensure LGBTQ plus people everywhere are safe, celebrated, empowered, and loved. And on Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket, LGBTQ plus people and those who love them are served by PFLAG Cape Cod, which was formed in 1989.
All right. And when and why did you get involved with PFLAG?
Excuse me. I got involved about 3 years ago. I have a child who came out as trans, and I felt like I needed support around that. I have another child who's part of the LGBTQ plus community, and that I felt I could understand a little bit better. This one, I felt like I needed some support and didn't want to turn to my child to burden them with all of that. So I turned to PFLAG and became involved, and they were wonderful in terms of providing me with support and education and ways of becoming a better ally. So, yeah. And then got involved and became a board member.
All right. So this has been a tough time for LGBTQ people everywhere, but especially difficult for youth. What are you hearing from these kids and their families about how the current political climate is impacting them?
Mm-hmm. Well, we host monthly support meetings for parents, family members, and allies and members of the LGBTQ plus community. It's an opportunity for people to gather, whether a virtual meeting or our in-person support meetings. It's an opportunity for people to gather and in a safe and supportive space to share their concerns, learn from each other and their respective journeys. And I will say that in terms of recently, it was pretty immediate after the 2024 presidential election, where attendance at our Brewster support meeting, which was our only in-person support meeting at the time, tripled. Mm. And all of a sudden, mostly parents were showing up whom I had never met before, who had maybe been involved with the organization in some way. Maybe they were members, but they just never attended any of the support meetings. Suddenly, they just kind of came out of the woodwork, because they were genuinely frightened for their child, whether it's an adult child or a younger child, and what might be coming and what might be laying ahead. you know, in the years ahead because of the rhetoric that had been, you know, spoken about during, you know, the election season. So parents are frightened. And anyways, also because we had attendance dramatically increase at the Brewster meeting, we said, I think we need to expand our base of operation a little bit here and open up or resume another in-person support meeting elsewhere in the Cape to make it a little bit more accessible. So we opened one up in Falmouth just a year ago in February, and attendance there has been phenomenal as well. So clearly there is a need mm-hmm. for people in the community, parents, family members, and allies, as well as members of the LGBTQ community, to meet and have an opportunity to discuss their concerns and their fears and hopefully support one another moving forward. And it, like I said, it was pretty dramatic yeah. increase since the 2024 election.
Nico touched on some of the legislation that we've seen around the country. And Anne, before we went on the air, you were telling me the number of bills and things that have been put forth is really mind-boggling.
Yeah, yeah. In 2026, there's 738 anti-trans bills under consideration across the country. And the number is anticipated to increase. Of those bills, 15 have passed. 29 have failed, and the rest are still active.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let listeners know our number if they'd like to chime in this morning. It's 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're seeing many states prohibit gender-affirming care for minors. Is that still protected in Massachusetts for youth? Where are we at, Massachusetts? Yeah?
Yeah.
It is.
Massachusetts
it
has a shield law in place.
And are we hearing of families relocating to Massachusetts because of our support for LGBTQ rights?
Yeah.
And access to health care.
Yeah.
So I'm even hearing at some of the support meetings this kind of almost like an underground network, for lack of a better term, that some parents have had to rely on as a way of accessing care for people who might be living in a different state where that care has been taken away. You know, it's like these underground networks of families trying to like provide care or access to care in ways that they may not be able to get it, you know, conventionally. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, Massachusetts has definitely become a bit of a refuge for people in other states.
But even in Massachusetts, we are affected by it. Fenway Health, which was a health clinic in Boston that was providing gender-affirming care for youth, no longer can because their funding was threatened by the federal government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they serve a huge amount of anti-trans adults, so they felt like they were between a rock and a hard place. So that gender-affirming care was lost in Massachusetts.
And, you know, we sort of mentioned there's so many misconceptions people have. And Nico just touched on this as well. How do you work to combat those misconceptions and educate people on the struggles that these kids face?
Right.
It's not easy. Mm-hmm. I mean, at times we feel like we're just preaching to the choir, but I think being on this show this morning is certainly one way to try to reach an audience that might be skeptical or have their doubts about, you know, some of this information. I think the level of mis and disinformation out there has made it really, really challenging. People having the impression that gender-affirming care means that teenagers are having surgeries, and that's just so not the case. It's very, very, very rare.
Right.
In fact, I was doing a little bit of homework for this, and ironically, gender-affirming care is much more common amongst cisgender people than transgender. And cisgender people are people who were, you know, assigned their sex at birth and have grown up always feeling comfortable in that sex. But I read an interesting statistic about, you know, gender-affirming care for boys and men who are cisgender for breast reduction is much, much more common than it is for trans youth who are trying to, you know, undergo a same procedure. So there's this kind of unfair treatment of the same procedure. If you're trans, you are not allowed to have this.
Yeah.
But if you're a teenage cisgender boy or adult cisgender man, that's allowed.
Mm. Talk about unfair. We were talking about names before. And I know I saw one of the workshops that you offer was this, the whole legal process of changing your name.
Yes.
And you brought up a really interesting point, Joe. We don't do that to other people. many people don't go by their name on their birth certificate, right? They have nicknames or, you know, what exactly. Go by a middle name or initials.
Yeah.
And we don't think anything of it.
No, I mean, I pretty much started experiencing that as soon as our family came to this country when I was 5 and a half. My birth name is José, which is Portuguese, but no one when I was growing up could ever know how to say that. So I pretty much learned in kindergarten that I just call me Joe. And that's pretty much the name that I go by. And that's the name that everyone uses other than my mom. But you know, no one questions it. Everyone accepts it. This is the name that I want. And this is the name that I, you know, would respect being called. You know, I think you and I were talking about this earlier, Mindy, you know, is Mindy your name that you were given at birth? But if it isn't, you know, everyone calls you that and they respect that choice of yours, you know, to be called that.
Right. It's Melinda, but nobody calls me that, though. And there's something kind of, I would think, empowering about choosing a name, right? You know, but we don't get to choose our name when we're born. Mm-hmm. But here's an opportunity for these kids to choose a name they feel like fits them and fits their personality.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. It's very powerful.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know of people who are not trans who change their name at some point in their life. Maybe they embark on a huge like change in their lives and they decide, you know, this is our new chapter and they want to change their name to kind of fit who they feel they now are moving forward. And it has nothing to do with trans identity. It's just that's just who they feel they now need to be called, you know. Yeah.
The other thing about that is that it's a really easy, accessible, anybody can do it way to be an ally, you know, to use the correct pronouns that somebody identifies as and asks you to use, and to use the name that they've chosen.
Yeah.
It's so easy to do, and it doesn't cost you anything, but it means the world to them.
All right, I'm talk about pronouns for a second, because, Joe, you and I had this conversation a week or so ago where I said, I get confused with they, because, you know, we grew up and they is plural, right? So, like, they, what is it? But you gave such a great explanation that really helped me in my mind, and it was, I think you were telling a story about if somebody calls, if you don't know the gender. So tell that story that you told to me.
Exactly. I mean, a lot of people really get fixated on, well, they, them is a plural and it shouldn't be used in the singular. And like, okay, maybe that's what we all learned, you know, in grammar school growing up. But the reality is they, them has been used in the singular for a long, long time. I think even since the time of Shakespeare. But I use examples, a simple one, you know, the one that I gave you was, you know, if I'm at home with my husband and he takes a phone call and then he hangs up. And then after he hangs up, I'm like, who was that on the phone? What did they want? Because I did not know who he was talking to. I had no sense of their gender. So to me, it made sense. I used they. You know, someone could find a phone and they turn it into lost and found. Oh, someone left their phone behind. Mm-hmm. Someone lost their phone. Mm-hmm. We use their and we don't even think about it. We don't bat an eye. Right. I was on NPR's website recently reading an article about, you know, the Venezuelan invasion. There was a great article where a reporter who did not want to be identified for security reasons, you know, how the report, can I read this to you?
Sure.
It says, a journalist in Caracas who NPR are not naming for safety reasons told us they woke up to two explosions at La Carlota military airport located across the street from their home. They saw two fires on the runway that were quickly extinguished immediately afterward. They reported hearing similar. What I'm getting at is that this reporter used they when talking about a singular person because that person's gender is not being, you know, disclosed.
I also feel like some of it is my age anyway. You know, grew up, as you're saying.
It's a generational.
Because when you talk to young, like I have a niece who's, you know, barely 20-ish, right? And none of this is confusing to them. Mm-hmm. So we have to pay attention to get the explanations from
it's
them.
It's neural pathways. You have to reprogram them.
Yeah.
And that's a real thing for us older people, for sure.
Yeah.
But I will say, you know, with repetition, it becomes easier. And, and the other thing to remember, too, is, you know, give yourself a little bit of license. You know, if you mess up, you know, just correct yourself and move on.
Right.
You know, we do it all the time.
Yeah. All right. In Nico's book, the teens he follows have supportive families, but that, of course, is not always the case. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about, I'm sure you see some of those kids who come to your support groups. Talk about how do we, you know, where can they turn? Besides, and PFLAG is one place, right?
Well, first of all, you know, PFLAG, if you're under 18, to come to the support meetings, you have to have at least a guardian, one guardian coming. So that actually is kind of an issue for younger people.
Mm, yeah, yeah. We do have on occasion a parent that might bring their under 18-year-old child with them. It's not common. So our organization generally focuses more of our resources and support on the adults that mm-hmm. are then able to be educated and then better support mm-hmm. their younger people in their lives, you know. But we do often recommend or offer services to youth that other organizations offer. We'll recommend or refer them to.
So there are other places that they can turn.
There are here on the Cape.
Yeah, because it's mm-hmm. it just seems like, you know, we look at the suicide rate, especially among mm-hmm. the trans population, and you can understand why. They're so isolated, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, it's feel so all alone, especially if they don't have any kind of support. Mm-hmm. It's a really difficult situation to be in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about, you know, I loved in the book, we talked about this Clint's coming out to his parents and giving his mom the card. It's a boy. Now, I don't know that every mom would have reacted the same way his mom did, but that's a tough decision mm-hmm. on how you come out mm-hmm. and to who.
Yeah.
Right? Right. Absolutely. Yeah. The importance of having at least one adult in your life that you can trust and that you can talk to is a protective factor for trans kids. And everybody's different, you know. Mm-hmm. And clearly it depends a lot on how safe you feel in your family. And even when you do feel safe in your family, there's always that, you know, well, I'm not 100% sure, you know, that can impact, like, how an individual goes about doing that, for sure.
Right. Yeah. And that fear of rejection is
absolutely
huge. Yeah.
Yeah, but we've heard from some interesting stories from parents about how their child has come out to them, sometimes as openly as on social media, just putting a post out there and the parents finding out that way sometimes. So it's, you know, it all depends on how that person wants to share or let people into who they are.
I would imagine that you also see parents who don't agree. One mm-hmm. parent who is very supportive and another who is not. Mm-hmm. Do you often get them able to bring that non-supportive parent into some of these support groups, or how does that work?
It's there are definitely our parents that show up where one, more often than not, it tends to be the mother, is the one who's attending the meeting, and the dad is just not yet ready to do that, or just clearly not supportive and does not have any interest. And that's a challenge and a struggle for that family, for that couple. I've heard stories of some couples that have to part ways because mm-hmm. the parent just absolutely needs to be there for their child. And if the other parent is not on board with that, you know, that's just a challenge to navigate. And they just, you know, maybe it's better that the parents separate so that the mother can be with the child and raise it alone, maybe.
Yeah. And to protect them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the support groups and how many more number, the Brewster tripled mm-hmm. and you've started this one in Falmouth. Are these, who are these people? Are they mostly parents that are coming to these support groups? Or
I would say it's probably like 50% parent. You know, it varies. The percentages vary from month to month and from location. I would say about 50% are parents, and then the other might be a grandparent, might be just an ally, maybe a trans person or another person who's LGBTQ+. Mm-hmm. So it depends month to month. You know, same with our virtual support meetings.
I would think, I say this for any issue you have, support groups are great because mm-hmm. you go, oh, see, it's not just me, yeah. right? And, oh, how did you handle it? You get ideas on how to handle things. And I'm wondering, you said you reached out to PFLAG initially because you wanted information. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I just called and talked to somebody that, you know, was on the board of PFLAG, and they told me what, you know, was available to me. And I went to a support meeting, and it was a safe space, you know, to just, even if you don't want to talk, you can sit and listen and get so much from it. And it's so important, I think. What I love to hear is when parents of trans kids come in and they say, I wanted to understand more about it and how to be an ally, what it's like for them, without burdening them mm-hmm. with having to do that work for me, because trans kids are already dealing with so much on their own about figuring themselves out. To also then ask them to help you understand is an enormous burden. So that's one reason why I think the PFLAG support groups are so important, because parents really, they come and they say, I am so glad I came here, because I really feel you understand me, but I'm also getting my questions answered, you know, like, and I can do a better job supporting and loving my child through the process.
How did your trans kid respond to that when you started going to the meetings? Was that
100% thrilled? Yeah. Okay, this is, that I don't have to do this kind of work for you. Like, you're doing your own emotional work. You're getting your own information out there, and they don't feel like they have to take care of my feelings as well as their own. Yeah. So they were thrilled.
I think you brought up a good point too. It's a safe space. You don't have to worry about, you know, judgment, right? And also exactly. that somebody understands what you're going through. There's exactly. somebody who's been through what you're going through.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the beauties of the meetings is that, you know, someone who might just have learned that they have a transgender child, you know, they have questions, they're overwhelmed, they have a lot of uncertainty. They can go to the meeting and there may be another parent or two who was in the same boat a few years before. And now they are, you know, all on board and allies and supportive of their child. And now they can be a real helpful resource for this parent who's just coming along, who needs that kind of support. That peer-to-peer support is hugely important. And like Anne was saying, to not burden their child or family member with questions and with statistics and information. It's like, no, this is the parent needs to kind of get it together on their own. And this organization, People at Cape Cod, you know, and the support groups is one way to do that.
I would think also, too, we talked about all of this legislation that's pending and some of it pretty scary. Mm-hmm. You know, we heard about the family in Texas. They want to punish parents as abusers, right? That can be really scary. You, of course, you want your child to be happy. You want to protect your child. And you've got all this kind of scary stuff happening on the political front. Yeah. Coming together, I imagine with support groups, it's helpful, right, to be able to advocate as a group rather than as a single individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much. And the thing that's sad is that, you know, these are issues that, you know, had been, you know, handled by parents and their child and their, you know, medical providers and therapists. But suddenly politicians felt like it was time to get involved and put up all these roadblocks. It's like, no, leave it to these individual families and their situations instead of the politicians who have other agendas in mind, you know?
Yeah. And don't have the expertise they need.
Exactly.
All right. So for people who wanted to get involved, how do they get involved? What can they do?
Oh, well, they can go to our website, pflagcapecod.org. They can see what we're all about. If they're interested in getting involved, they can just go to our, I think we have a volunteer form. We have a contact form. They can reach
resources.
Out. Resources. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got our website is chock-a-block full of resources. We have a podcast series called Profiles in LGBTQ Plus Courage, which is on our website as well as on every podcast platform that's out there. We have booklets that we give away at community events and support meetings and that people can also request and we'll mail to them for free. We have a comprehensive glossary of terms. We offer scholarships.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, the comprehensive glossary of terms. It's pretty comprehensive. Just go to the resources tab on our website. And we also offer scholarships to graduating high school seniors, you know.
Oh,
and since I think since 2003, we've awarded over $105,000 in scholarships.
Wow.
So we offer a lot.
So Nico Lang is going to be reading from their book, American Teenager, How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era. That's Thursday, March 26th at Hyannis Arts Hall. That's the one you're supporting, PFLAG.
Correct.
And Thursday, March 31st in Provincetown at the UU Meeting House. We'll post more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Joe Lima, president of PFLAG Cape Cod, and Ann Sylvia, board member of PFLAG. Thanks for being here and sharing your expertise with us. We appreciate it.
You're very
thank
welcome.
You for having us, and thank you for putting this episode out there. It's really important.
Thank you so much.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.